Because after that, you can do what you like. Because when I start looking at my talk, I really literally can't see you. So, if you want to get comfy and all that, go ahead. If you want to disappear under your screen, that's fine. So, okay, let's go. Okay, so good morning, everybody, and welcome, and thank you to all of you that are attending in person, and thank you to those of you that are maybe zooming in on another time to listen to the recording. So as you know, some of you might know that we've been studying the Zandokai. Vicky started us off with a three-part series. It's paralleling some of the studies that we're doing with our study group, and somewhere in there, somebody thought it would be a good idea if we, and then somebody threw up their hand, and then so the three of us, I'm sure, were wondering what we did. But it is book by Shinryu Suzuki that if some of you didn't catch on the first talk, it is actually downloadable as a free PDF if you want to follow that. And then I've used a few other sources, but so I'm doing the middle part, which is actually chapters 5 and 8, and I'll just go over those in a little bit of time. And I'm just in that book, though, on Suzuki talks about studying and preparing for talks. And I think I'm going to embroider this because it's the advice here is it may not be important to the student, but the teacher needs to prepare, even though it doesn't help. So, but before you lecture, you should study. So I did, but we'll see how it goes, right? So on that, just a little of a recap too on the meaning of Sandokai. In our chants, you will see it as written out as the harmony of difference and equality. But there's lots of other interpretations which have to do with the language and transmission from language to language to list. So there's lots of other ones that sometimes might resonate a little bit better. Harmony, difference and equality is ours, identity of relative and absolute, the unity of one and many, inquiry into matching halves, the coincidence of opposites, the agreement of meeting together. So there's all kind of, and that sort of gives you a flavor of what the Sandokai means, right? So there is some language translation about Sandokai, which is three words. San literally meaning three, but in our context means things or other interpretations or the meaning of difference, diversity, and variety. It's also listed as a synonym for the word ji, which comes up in our discussion later on for the concrete or phenomenal aspect of our life. And do is about sameness and to identify one thing with another, and it speaks more to equality and commonality. It's the synonym of ri, the absolute ultimate reality of emptiness beyond discrimination. And kai is to shake hands, to completely understand the relationship between one great whole being and the many facets of that one great whole. There was a little side that I came across. Oh, I should have mentioned too, most of my sources are going to be Okumura and Burke and Norman that I found. So that's, you'll hear me waving back and forth with that. There's one little story around Kai is it's just like we have, they use legal terms, and that the halves of a tally, and so that when they were making a contract, they would literally split the two halves together, and then the contract would come together as a seamless. So the imagery there is that these, the two halves of the tally work together as a seamless reality. That's interesting. So the part of the poem that I'm going to discuss, and I have no idea how long this is going to take, so I've decided that I'll just ramble on until I notice the time. And we'll hopefully, and that I would suggest to you that, like Vicky said, there was like 22 couplets that basically kind of say a lot of the same thing in a lot of different ways, you know, it seems to be what's going on. So I would suggest you don't hang on to anything too hard and just let it drift and float around until something lands. But the sections I'm going to, and I'm just going to, and I'm not sure if people are reading along, but I'll just read it out. So my section is going to be: sights vary in quality and form, sounds differ as pleasing and harsh, refined and common speech come together in the dark, clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, thus for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common, each has its speech. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. So for anybody that was following along on the PDF, this is chapter 5. And on each of these sections, there's also sort of a subtitle. So in the first section, we're talking about sights vary in quality and form, etc. And the subtitle is, today we may be very happy, and the next day we don't know what will happen. So I'll just go through this bit by bit and we'll see what happens. So the first part, sights vary in quality and sound, form, sounds differ as pleasing and harsh. So the sights and sounds is actually a form of shorthand that is representing all the senses, even though it just speaks of sight and sounds, it includes all, which are sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and perception. And they're all sense objects. And the perception, which is including the mind, which senses mental formations. And of each of these, they all have varied natures and characteristics. And of each, so we'll have, we're all human, but we vary. But as a human, we all have common and unique aspects. The part about pleasing or harsh is speaking again to variations, and it all depends on the property of each thing and the condition of our body and mind. It's also suggestion around agreeable or disagreeable, attachment or aversion, and the subjectivity of the listener, for lack of a better word. Most of this, my impression was, is that was looking at the next two lines, which, and the emphasis on the words dark and light. So refined and common speech coming together in the dark, clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The explanation for the darkness is a word for merging upper and lower, and light is an expression for distinguishing pure and defiled. So that's one way. Darkness and light are also described as the difference between non-discrimination and discrimination. And within that, we have synonyms, me and my language. It's for back to the G, which is independence, and re-universality. And so the analogy, or the one that probably resonates, is the of the hand with five fingers, and each finger having different shapes and functions and names. But you can't separate the fingers from the hand. and likely in the same thread that the hand, body, human, ecology of the earth. Earth is a small part of the universe. Nothing is fixed and nothing is actually independent. Okimura talks about that in this context, we already know our individuality. And the first thing that needs to be learned is to see the universality of our life and the interdependences of our lives. And that's sort of the central Buddhist teaching. Other things that come as far as definitions or ways of understanding dark is the absolute or the larger perspective. Things are just the way that they are, and only we make the distinctions. And then light has relative and absolute. In a relative sense, things do have qualities. But this all gets kind of tricky, and I don't know about you, but I work really hard to try and keep this, you know, organized, but, you know, so, and I've probably gotten a few parts backwards, but I do like this part with Shunru, where speaks of that nothing exists when seen from the viewpoint of utter darkness or absolute, that which exists is nothingness or darkness, in which the many exist as one. So subject and object are one, but they are also two. So the suggestion is if you understand all of this completely and that you understand this perspective of reality, you'll not be bothered by anything because Buddhas know both sides of reality and they have this composure. And, you know, that kind of goes into a little bit of a warning, though, that just in case you think you get this all and you understand it, you shouldn't do that. It's just like you're going to cling to this and, you know, that's not quite it either. But this is sort of a flavor of knowing, having a view of both sides, having the composure, not being completely involved with one thing or the other without, you know, sort of a neutrality. And that when we see this reality, we're appreciating that the words aren't helping us. We might just actually, in fact, get lost with that. But when we practice Zazen and with this in mind, without seeking enlightenment, without seeking for any other understanding, that is true enlightenment. So I'm going back to the chat, you know, the subheading where today we may be very happy and the next day we don't know. Here's that the lesson in this is that, you know, in here you should be happy. You should just enjoy the happiness. And I think Vicky talked about this or somebody, you'll probably hear similar like hot Buddha, cold Buddha when you're practicing in that. It's just that acceptance in that state. And even though circumstances may change suddenly, we don't mind. So today we might be very happy and the next day we don't know what will happen. When we are ready for what will happen for tomorrow, we can enjoy today completely. But don't get too caught up in word games. What am I doing here? So chapter 6, the boat is always moving. And the parts of that are the four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Apparently, all of these are not to be taken too literally as far as just appreciating that the gross elements that they're referring to are the four gross elements, fire, wind, water, and earth. But it's not so much the actual element of earth, but the elements are representations of our lives. So, and there's some correlation on what that means for us. So that fire represents body heat, and the nature of fire is to purify. Wind is breath and movement. And according to Shinru, wind brings things to maturity, but he doesn't know why. I thought it was kind of cute. Like, okay, he's puzzled. But it was a comparison of things being more organic versus fire, which is a chemical process. Water refers to blood, tears, or other bodily fluids, and that the nature of water is to contain things, which is opposite to our usual thinking. And he describes it like water in the trunk of a tree. Water contains the trunk of a tree as well as the branches and leaves. And water is vast in everything, including ourselves. And earth, as far as a bodily representation, is our bones, nails, hair. And again, they're saying earth does not mean the land, but rather the solid nature of matter. And so we're talking about things returning, elements returning to their natures. Now, what got kind of interesting to me and reading all of this stuff was there's sort of a Coles version of all of this by Boyko. I might have that wrong, but I can correct that later. And his commentary is that the interpretation of returning to their natures is, despite their undeniable differences in characteristics and function, the four elements, all things, are fundamentally empty. And I'm like, where'd that come from? Because nowhere in here does it say the word empty. So I'm like, okay. And this is the way I kind of figured it. And the rest of the commentary started talking about emptiness and appreciating that sense of emptiness. And it reminds me a little bit about when I struggled with math, and that they would give you some definitions and formulas. And then there was a couple of little things that they forgot to mention that was inherent in the understanding. And one of the things that's inherent in the understanding is around the fifth element, or as a form, an element is emptiness or space. So there's a lot of discussion around being, you know, Shinru talks about the nature of the atom and the energy and breaking things down, all those elements breaking it down, and that elements are not just matter, they're both spirit and matter, including thinking. The elements are here, but they're nothing but a momentary formation of the final emptiness. And so I just sort of point that out, that, you know, it's helpful to know this when you start looking at some of the other stuff that we do, and that there's, I think there's even an unsaid that gets brought into the conversation. So Boyko says too, that it's not that things are actually empty, or despite emptiness, there appears to be things, so that we have our shape or form, rocks. Emptiness is defined as a potential and actually makes it possible for things to manifest. And so we get into this dialogue where, you know, just as there's not a child without a mother, a mother without a child, emptiness defines things and things define emptiness. So each element or representation of our lives, if we were going to use the other, has its own nature, fire, heat, wind, moves, etc. And these five elements combine to form one body, one mind, and one person. And not only this one person, but everything in this universe is composed of five elements. Everything is just a collection of these elements, and yet each being, each thing maintains its independence. And it's really wondrous, and yet this is reality. And so we get into this whole, and then I sort of kept, so what does this thing mean about the boat is always moving? Because it's still not quite clear. But it talks about appreciating each thing one by one and experiencing pure gratitude. Oh, there was something beautiful. And one of the things that they said that it's an expression is that you see this beautiful thing and you're out in the boat and you notch the rail of the boat in order to mark the location. But that doesn't make sense, because marking doesn't help, because the boat is moving, and it shows the foolishness of thinking dualistic mind versus Buddhist non-dualistic mind. And so the lesson is that appreciating what we see here right now. What a beautiful flower, for example. Appreciate and don't mark the boat. These lines express the understanding of what Akimuro calls independency. No, actually, that's wrong guy. Shinru. Each one of you is independent, but you're related to each other. We say independent without awareness of dependent. It's not a Buddhist view of reality, but we use this to try and understand completely. There we go. So, we're getting there. Chapter 7. Ah, this is exhausting. Just and Flo sitting there going, "Ooh, I'm next." I can see Flo. She's like the only person I see. Flo, Kate, and Michael, whoever says the only people I can actually see. So chapter 7, which is without any idea of attainment, just to sit as our way. And the verses that correlate to that. Oh, I should mention too, after a while, there's like, they've got them in chapters, but this stuff seems to like go back and forth. So eventually I somewhat gave up on trying to correlate them, but I gave it a good college try. Let's put it that way. So the verses here, eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. Thus for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered in common. Each has its speech. And again. So it's a repetition, talking about the senses, which are forms, and that these forms are interdependent phenomenon. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, all of these are dharma, and each dharma is rooted in the absolute or Buddha nature. And they ask to look beyond these appearances and know how each exists. Feeling the oneness of the subjective and the objective worlds, the oneness of eye and form, the oneness of tongue and taste. And those sort of, and we can go on with that. And that thus with everything, interactions give rise to new phenomenon, manifestations, and there's a chain of causation and resultant phenomenon. Because of the root, we exist. Because of the absolute Buddha nature, we exist. Understanding things in this way, we have oneness. So the reference to the tree branches and essence, just a few. The trunk represents absolute source. Branches are the relative phenomenon. Sharing the essence are the absolute and relative aspects of the same thing. So that trunk plus branches equals tree. Revered makes reference to the absolute and supreme, and common is relative and worldly, and each having its own speech or manner of expression. And it kind of harkens back to this, I thought a little bit about where there was the discussion that Vicky drew our attention to about the two schools of Buddhism, and that both are the nature of Buddhism, and they're both true to themselves, but they're both part of one. And the big caveat there is not to attach a whole lot of special meaning to anything. And not to, the sense of humility again, repeat, on not feeling especially good if you this was more around just understanding and thinking, oh, what a clever person I might be, just kind of just let go about all of those kinds of meanings. And just to appreciate that all of this, or this whole idea of independency working together, our activity and universe all become one, our body and mind work together with our environment to create one world. So I got back again, and like I find, some of this I had to dig a little bit with, so then I go back to without any idea of attainment, just to sit as our way. And so we get started this with to be completely involved in sitting is our zazen and how we observe our precepts and just observing our way and the absence of dualistic thinking. I will share with you though that for whatever reason, something kind of sat a little bit twigged, and it's sort of one of these that we talk about the assumption that our meditation is zazen, and then I kind of got digging a little bit more around it, and that I came across a lovely article about from Isho Fujita, and he's part of the group that came to America, and anyhow, he wrote a thing about that. And there was some very neat stuff that kind of came out of that for me that I thought I would share with you. That sort of, to me, ties this all in together. I'm sorry, I'm just having a little look-see on what I did with it because I just wanted to do it a little bit of better honor. He's written, Zazen is not the same as meditation. And he came with Valley Zendo, which is in the interior U.S., with Koshi Ishida and Stephen Yenek. They came from Kyoto, and then Shohaku Okumura and Eishin Akita. So those are names that are kind of familiar to us, if you can understand my pronunciation. So, and you know, I thought it was useful here where he looks at what Dogen talked about, that Zazen, if first and foremost, is a holistic body posture. And it goes beyond mind-body dualism, both body and the mind, simultaneously and completely used up just by the act of sitting. And it focuses more on the living, holistic mind-body framework, allowing the head to exist without giving any preeminence. In Zazen, we move from the head to the heart and into our Buddha nature. And then he quotes Kodo Sobaki, Zazen is to tune into the universe. And that, to me, was just like really gave a lot greater texture to this portion of the poem on without any idea of attainment, just to sit at our way, and the, how that embodies all of these aspects about senses and non-duality and interdependency, along with being with our independent natures. I can share that later if people are interested in that. So, watching the time. Looks like I'm going to get through this. Chapter 8. Within the light, there is utter darkness. And the last two stanzas. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the light, dark, there is light, but don't see it in light. And the discussion in this was got to be pretty interesting because it got into what I discovered for myself was sort of the problem of English and translations and where our minds sort of kind of automatically gravitate. So, for example, darkness is classically for English speakers is associated with a negative and lack of discrimination. And light can mean intellectualization, the European meaning with the accumulation of knowledge. Light can be relative and represent the dualistic world of words, the thinking world, the visible world, and darkness, the absolute, no exchange value or materialistic, in a place where words and thinking mind can't reach. But darkness or brightness is within your mind. Other discussion talks about light referring to samsara. And again, that's sort of opposite a little bit to probably where we would classically think that it's a nature, it's part of the nature of dukkha and suffering and unsatisfactory states of mind. And darkness is equated to nirvana, which is a release from samsara, non-self and emptiness and non-discrimination. And so this is sort of leading into this whole trickiness of everything. So that the first meaning of light is to use our intellect to see things. And this is with lack of discrimination, not only from the outside of ourselves, but inside, but we call this discrimination. And if darkness is a lack of discrimination or intellect, light as rational discrimination are paired. Darkness is negative and light is positive. So then we kind of go back and forth, you know. So this actually just was interesting about how, depending on your point of view, and so he talks again about the second pair with light as a negative, discrimination from limited view, and darkness as a positive, non-discriminating way of seeing. So in that, and this is Akimura, on that part of the poem, he changes one word and he goes from, instead of in the light there is darkness, but, he suggests that therefore is the better word for but. Because lightness and darkness are always together and we cannot understand our life through only one aspect. And these are likened with both inseparable aspects of reality. And we get into nirvana is in samsara, which is within some, and vice versa. And so we can't use light in only one concept. We can't use it as delusion and as a product, and to appreciate that it's a product of our mind and that our brain has the power to produce delusion in reality. So it gets into that back and forth, not looking at it in one perspective. That's how I'm seeing. I'm just looking. Sorry, I'm going through my notes. I find all this quite mind-blowing. You know, just rather, you know. So if you're doing the same thing, you're in good company. So I'm just trying to look at sort of a summary on this whole kind of, and simplifying it a little bit. And there's two, actually there's three, about looking at the story in The Branching Streams. Suzuki talks about looking at the story of a meal and that how all our various bits, we can look at that as separate. As there's cheese, there's, you know, eggs, there's vegetables, you know, as separate entities. But once we eat them and they go into our tummy, it's all indistinguishable. And only then does things start to, all of the magic starts to work. And so in the same vein that we shouldn't be looking at the idea of lightness or darkness, we shouldn't be clinging to the idea of equality or differentiation. And if, as Buddhists, the hope is that we would be able to shift our minds from back and forth. And he's saying bad to good, good to bad, but one could argue those aren't probably what he's talking about. And so just to set aside a lot of these sort of notions about figuring it all out and which one's which, and just to appreciate and study it. And there's two more bits that I'm going to leave you with. There is another meaning of light called the Buddha's wisdom, or later obtained discriminating wisdom, which is based on non-discrimination. In our daily lives, we have to discriminate to practice and to help others. In this case, non-discrimination means non-attachment. This light is called prajna, and it's described in the Heart Sutra as the bright mantra. It's very important we go beyond non-discrimination. And then my final bit, because I'm kind of a simple soul, I looked at Norman, and apparently he talked about this at one of our Loon Lakes, and he talked about a description about Sandokind and what, and he... he was recanting Katagiri Roshi, and Katagiri Roshi always perks up my ears, and not the way you think. It's quite silly. But when my robes were being made, my outer robes, my kimora and stuff, the lady that was sewing them told me that she sewed Katagiri Roshi's robes and that my forearm and Katagiri were exactly the same length. And they were a little bit on the short side. She had me remeasure it because, and then she told me that. So I'm like, oh, I'm totally bonded to Katagiri. And I've read some of his stuff and he is truly charming. But Norman recants about Katagiri and what a wonderful person. And he remembers very vividly Katagiri Reishi putting his palms together carefully and meticulously in Gassho and saying, this hand is delusion, this hand is enlightenment. This is our practice, putting the two together in one gesture. So when you put your hands together in the Zendo and bow to your seat, or when you're walking by someone and bow to that person in passing, think of this practice as Sandokai. You are saying, yes, I know this is a cushion that somebody manufactured and paid for and transported to this place, but it's also the sacred Bodhi mandala. This is literally the place where the Buddha sat. When you bow to another person, you are saying, yes, there is another poor soul just like me who is Buddha. In this way, we can be very realistic about one another and about ourselves, but at the same time, accord ourselves and one another to the ultimate respect, Sandokai. So I thank you for your attention or your sleepiness or whatever else you got up to, which is fine. I truly don't mind. And for your patience. And we'll look forward to Flo's finishing touch. You know, I feel like I was in the sandwich there. There was Vicky and Flo and the nice, soft, shiny bread. And I'm maybe a little bit of the alpha sparts in the middle. So we'll sort of go from there. So, but thank you. And we'll close and chant the closing verse, and then we'll move into service. Okay.